Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the International History Institute at Boston University and featuring University of California Irvine professor Emily Rosenberg. Professor Rosenberg's lecture is part of a series titled The Short American Century, 1941 to 2008, Contrasting Views of the Era of American Dominance. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Professor of History and International Relations, Andrew Bacevich.
Tonight, we are privileged to have Professor Emily Rosenberg speak to us. Professor Rosenberg teaches at the University of California at Irvine, and her interests are in the history of U.S. economic and cultural expansion from the late 19th century to the present. She received her PhD in the previous century at State University of New York, Stony Brook, and before going to UC Irvine, she taught for many years at McAllister College up in Minnesota. She is a past president of the Society for the Historians of American Foreign Relations. She is the author of many important books. Certainly the one that I first came to know of her work was Spreading the American Dream, American Economic and Cultural Expansion, 1890-1945. But since then, among others, there's been Financial Missionaries rather to the world, and A Date Which Will Live, Pearl Harbor in American Memory. So thanks again for joining us this evening, and thanks so much for flying out all the way from California to join us. We're really very grateful for that. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me. Henry Luce, in 1941, gave a famous vision for an American century that set forth a very broad definition of power and influence. And nestled within his discussion came this really interesting paragraph. Once we cease to distract ourselves with lifeless arguments about isolationism, we shall be amazed to discover that there is already an immense American internationalism. American jazz, American movies, American slang, American machines and patented products are in fact the only things that every community in the world from Zanzibar to Hamburg recognizes in common. Blindly, unintentionally, accidentally, and really in spite of ourselves, we are already a world power in all the trivial ways. His understanding that the American century, in some senses, meant a consumer century, provides my central theme tonight. And I will be looking at the topic of the American century, consumer century, in three parts. Part one will make the case that the United States became the world's first mass consumerist society and will analyze the distinctive circumstances within which that happened. Part two, I will argue that the United States spread mass consumerism worldwide after World War II, and that the American century during this period became a globalized consumer century. And in part three, I want to make the case that the consumer century, the globalized consumer century, once closely identified with the American century, ended up becoming its undoing. So we'll start with part one, in which I want to look at the sources of the mass consumerist society that developed in the United States in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. At that time, one of America's most distinguishing characteristics, and oddly its most intractable problem, appeared to be abundance. Two sources of that abundance might be emphasized. First, America's mass consumption rested on the commoditization of the continent's seemingly inexhaustible natural resources. Timber barons converted vast forests into personal fortunes. Agriculturalists plowed up the landscape. Mining companies extracted metals. Railroad moguls grew wealthy, opening new lands and shipping out all of these extracted products. Through government actions, such as protective tariffs, government-financed infrastructure, and the nurturing of strong domestic financial system, this natural bounty, which almost seemed to be free nature, was turned into commodities and wealth and stimulated industrial growth. Second, American entrepreneurs sought technological solutions to overcome the country's vast continental distances and its relative scarcity of labor. Revolutions in transportation, communication, and mass production had, by the 1890s, created many of the very huge U.S. companies whose names and consumer goods would become household words throughout the globe over the next century. In fact, under the influence of this almost free nature and the technological innovation spawned by vast distances, U.S. productive capacity became so vast by the 1890s that when a global economic contraction sent the world and domestic economy into a decline, business groups, politicians, and journalists all pretty much agreed that overproduction, not scarcity of goods, had become the major social problem of the age. Plagued by such abundance, America seemed to be turning Europe's dismal science, which was based on the idea of economic scarcity, on its head. In The New Basis of Civilization, a book published in 1907, the eminent American economist Simon Nelson Patton postulated that the era of scarcity that had been supplanted by an era of abundance that would become the new engine of a global civilizing process. Expanding markets became the solution to this American problem of abundance and central to its sense of mission in the world. Higher wages provided one way of expanding markets, and Henry Ford pioneered a new concept. Ford, of course, used assembly line technology to ruthlessly lower costs through standardization, while at the same time he raised wages so that workers could afford to buy his cars. Consumer-led growth appeared to be the solution to the uniquely American problem of abundance. The term American standard of living in this period became a widely used, if still very undefined, source of national pride. This rise of consumerism, however, was not simply an economic story shaped by these fears of overproduction. But I also want to emphasize that it arose within the context of America's singular social milieu. First, with no hereditary mobility or rigid class structure, Americans' material acquisition became one of the dominant indexes of social standing. Consumer goods in America generally served as visible signs of personal advancement. They took on aspirational qualities, seeming to confer glamour, leisure, and respect. Consumer goods fashioned an American dream of upward mobility and of ever-growing personal and national prosperity. Moreover, American-style consumerism was closely related to the creation of a national community out of a culturally diverse population. During the half century that we're talking about here, between 1880 and 1930, 27 million immigrants entered the United States, and perhaps in 1910, perhaps as much as 70% of the industrial labor force was foreign-born and mostly non-English speaking. In the face of this incredible multiplicity in language, custom, and history, mass-consumed commodities became markers of national as well as of personal identity. I would argue that a consumer society offered a set of common references around which a diverse people living in the United States could bond as Americans. Especially for first and second generation immigrants, blue-collar ethnics, consumption provided an Americanizing agent. It offered a materially grounded semiotics for constituting the American way. This is a phenomenon, by the way, that historian Charles McGovern has termed material nationalism or consumer citizenship, a source of nationalism resting in the consumer sector or consumer participation. Consumer goods and new entertainments offered ways to identify with others around comfort, leisure, and interests, rather than around the regional, ethnic, or familial associations that had once organized social life. Between 1900 and 1930, the growth of amusement parks, dance halls, movie theaters brought urban villagers, and especially the young, out of their own neighborhoods and ethnic backgrounds onto streetcars and increasingly into automobiles. New rituals of dating, new kinds of workplaces accompanied the relaxation of parental supervision. Women's lives, in particular, changed dramatically as mobility, mixing, and leisure beckoned with the accompanying hazards and opportunities. Brand identification, Coca-Cola, Kellogg cereals, Swift meats, White Castle hamburgers, forged new communities of consumption, to borrow a phrase from Daniel Boorstin. Consumerism played a role in expanding the working definition of the nation. To be let into the market was to be let into the national community. In this sense, then, mass consumerism rested both on an economic system that commodified the natural bounty of this rich continent and used technology to mass produce goods, and on a cultural system that was centered on the desires for self-fashioning and national belonging. So in this sense, I define mass consumerism as a mass production and mass marketing system that imagines a widespread abundance of goods within a culture that emphasizes purchasing, desire, glamour, and flexible consumption-driven identities. Now, this slide is designed to give you a quick history of the American advertising industry, which played a growing role in solving this crisis of abundance. Advertisers argued that the prosperity of the nation, and later they would argue of the world, depended upon the skill with which they could stimulate ever higher levels of purchasing and consuming, and therefore of jobs and prosperity. Buy more, prosper more, became their unofficial motto. Over the course of the 20th century, advertisers refined the art of psychological suggestion and developed survey techniques. During the 30s through the 60s, they embraced strategies of public relations and branding, creating an enduring and positive media symbol based more and more on a company's supposed ideals than upon specific products. During the last third of the 20th century, lifestyle advertising came to dominate advertising, and this developed associations between a brand and the social behavior of a particular group of people with whom the buyer might want to have an aspirational affinity. My point is how over the course of the 20th century, advertisers became increasingly adept at using various kinds of appeals to stimulate purchasing and to drive consumption-driven growth. Marketers from the 1920s on also developed ways to increase the volume of purchasing. They reworked familiar national holidays to involve more shopping, and they invented new ones like Mother's Day and Father's Day. Planned obsolescence and frequent style changes encouraged buyers to replace their consumer goods more rapidly. Designing disposability became a hallmark of the new consumer society. And perhaps most importantly, buying on credit and through installments spread throughout the economy. Finance became an important adjunct to advertising in cementing this new consumerist republic. So to sum up this section, I would argue that American advertisers, business, labor leaders, immigrant workers, politicians, for many of these, the American way and the American dream found expression as mass consumerism. Practices of consumerism, which answered America's problem of abundance, became finely knit into the nation's economic, social, cultural, and political institutions, and, as we will see in a moment, into its foreign policy as well. In this section, I'd like to argue that as the U.S. spread this style of mass consumerism worldwide after World War II, the American century became a globalized consumer century. America's Cold War strategy in the era of the American century, after 1941, built upon Luce's vision by exporting to the world the assumptions and practices of America's consumer republic. Mistaking America's specific historical circumstances, all those ones that we've just alluded to, for generalizable laws of development, U.S. leaders promoted the idea that a mass production, mass consumer system on the American model would lift living standards everywhere and counter the appeal of communism. Spreading the American century and spreading a consumer century seemed to be one and the same goal in the immediate post-war period. America's Advertising Council, for example, which was a body made up of major advertising agencies, carried out a global program from the late 1940s on to identify the quote, worldwide fight for freedom in the Cold War with advertising. They worked closely with the U.S. Department of State, and in this effort, they portrayed American advertising techniques as critical to the stimulation of consumer demand and therefore to economic recovery and job creation worldwide. The Ad Council also helped U.S. businesses develop overseas programs that bragged about their corporate-provided health care, recreational programs, and pension plans for workers. This message that was carefully crafted and sent worldwide was that high levels of consumption were connected directly to higher standards of living for workers, with high wages and good benefits. Buy more, prosper more, was the unofficial motto. Other Cold War cultural offensives also sold America as a consumer haven and as an exportable model. The European Economic Plan, the Marshall Plan, funded traveling displays that pictured America's high wages, bulging shops, and full shelves against the backdrop of European privation and post-war destruction. And as Marshall Plan money became a major source of advertising revenue for some European media, it also nudged Europe toward acceptance of commercial radio advertising, a trend that opened more and more spaces for the selling of both foreign and domestic products. Hollywood movies, encouraged by U.S. government pressure on other countries to repeal their restrictions and quotas, also acted as dazzling advertisements for consumer abundance. The new U.S. Information Agency, which was formed in 1953, made consumerism a major part of its Cold War cultural offensives. One USIA campaign, which was the outgrowth of an Advertising Council roundtable, was called People's Capitalism. And that the goal of this campaign was to counter the idea that communism was the best way of improving workers' lives. The major Cold War international expositions during the 1950s reflected this theme of people's capitalism. At the 1958 Brussels exhibition, for example, the American Pavilion displayed affordable washing machines, dishwashers, a Sears and Roebuck catalog, frozen food packages, TV and recording studios, and a pink built-in oven. American women, this show implied, enjoyed abundant leisure and access to inexpensive mass-produced clothing. They could slip easily among a variety of social roles simply by changing clothes. The American Exposition in Moscow a year later took such messages about the link between consumerism and freedom right into the heart of the communist world. Russian audiences here toured the 6-room ranch house that amazingly ordinary factory workers in America could afford on one salary. Fashion shows, this time 3 of them, again displayed stylish, mass-marketed attire. Helena Rubinstein and Coty Cosmetics offered free beauty treatments until the Soviet authorities banned the practice because they were so popular. And this time, no less than 3 model kitchens boasted appliances, convenient foods, and gadgets of all sorts. This, of course, was the setting for the famous kitchen debate between Vice President Richard Nixon and Premier Nikita Khrushchev, which occurred against this backdrop of consumerism. And I want you to notice how important gender roles are in promoting this consumerism, with women being very important to these exhibitions, appeals to women being very important. Communist leaders tried to respond to the challenge. Khrushchev pledged to improve housing and divert resources towards socialist visions of consumer goods. Similarly, East Germany's leaders, confronted with a flood of refugees fleeing to the West, expanded consumer credit mechanisms, introduced mail order catalogs, planned new self-service retail stores. In 1956, Khrushchev promised to help the East German government become a showcase of the Cold War. And in 1958, the East German Communist Party even pledged within 4 years, by 1962, to surpass West Germany in productivity and individual consumption. Well, the building of the Berlin Wall in that year, 1962, to staunch the migration to the West rather quickly underscored the failure of this goal and of Khrushchev's effort to reorient social planning toward personal consumption that would be able to seem to rival the West's. And by then, on both sides of the Cold War divide, consumer abundance had become widely accepted as an ultimate test of each system's claim on the future. Consumer abundance also marked the train of Cold War battle in Asia. After 1949, American Cold Warriors sought to contrast the poverty in Red China with the economic revitalization of America's allies in Japan and Taiwan. In hosting the Olympic Games in 1964, Japan made its debut as an American-guided, modernized nation. The Expo 70 exhibit in Osaka, the first expo in Asia, celebrated technology and displays of consumer products. Japan, at this exhibit, foreshadowed its own growing consumer specializations, introducing an early type of cell phone and other communications devices. Now, not everyone in the world, of course, welcomed American mass production and mass consumption techniques. Even as consumerist practices spread, critics from both left and right waged vociferous anti-Americanization campaigns. They portrayed Americanization as materialistic, conformist, feminized, immature. In France and elsewhere, they protested against American products, especially the heavily advertised Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola, indeed, became a symbol of unwanted, but also of wanted, Americanization. The growing scholarship on the post-war spread of consumerism, however, increasingly complicates any claim that the consumer revolutions that swept the world in the decades after World War II simply converged toward Coca-Colonization or toward some homogenized version of Americanization. As the American century spread consumer culture throughout the world and even into the communist bloc, mass consumerism became less and less an American phenomenon. The consumer century, in fact, spread by building its own local adaptations. Historian David Elwood, among many others, has emphasized how each country had its own filtering mechanisms to borrow from, adapt, and reject models from America, as these slides sort of illustrate. In most parts of the world, people were both attracted to and repelled by American models. The managerial style, the labor policies, the resource and technology-intensive qualities of the American corporate capitalism, the conspicuous consumption and seeming materialism, all of these things clearly had different valences in different places. And if many people yearned for the kind of affluence and individualism that the U.S. seemed to stand for, most also retained a strong respect for frugality and communitarian values. Mass consumerism spread globally, then, in diverse ways, within diverse contexts of local traditions and local cultural variants. Moreover, the notions of glamour and desire that were central to mass consumerism also grew from local contexts. Marketers created images of beauty, style, and sex appeal, often linked to stars and celebrities, and many of these star images, celebrity images, became broadly recognizable throughout the non-communist and then even in the communist world. But these conceptions of celebrity that are so central to consumerism were continually shaped and readapted as they circulated globally, as films of Federico Fellini suggest, and the cultural circulations that flow between Hollywood and Paris, as in Vanessa Schwartz's new book, illustrate this kind of flow also. Consumerism was increasingly part of a global circulation of images, but it adapted the face of whatever culture it reached. Images of desire did not flow just from the U.S. outward, but flowed in complex circuitry. Advertising played an important role in these localized consumer revolutions. Advertising, of course, flourished wherever trade barriers and media regulations fell. It flourished within the economic integration of the European Union. It flourished within the decline of economic nationalism in the Third World, and especially after the fall of communism. But more than that was at work. The shift to lifestyle advertising by the increasingly globalized advertising companies often bonded consumers into particular lifestyle groups by evoking and serving local values and traditions. Large American-based chains, Coca-Cola, KFC, McDonald's, and others, substantially altered their products to encourage local talent and accommodate regional tastes and customs. They even reinforced or even created unique characteristics in certain localities. More importantly, global consumerism broke loose from U.S.-based firms altogether. Within a few decades after the end of World War II, America had ceased to be the national home of the consumer century. The blurring of lines between the global and the local, which is a development that business theorists have called glocalization, spread consumerism around the globe. It now adopted various guises, and its seductions enveloped Western Europe, Japan, the communist systems in Eastern Europe, Russia and China, and the Third World. Indeed, many countries incorporated mass consumerism into their own ideologies of national advancement by promising citizens more access to consumer items. Those on the left and right who still tried to denounce America because of its identification with mass consumerism, or those who sought to denounce mass consumerism by calling it Americanization, those people found their arguments increasingly less and less relevant. As in the United States itself, the mass consumerist advertising complex appealed across lines of nationality, religion, ethnicity, gender, class, and ideology. Consumerism, one historian has commented, may have been the ism that really won the ideological battles of the 20th century. But I want to emphasize that it won less because it was closely associated with Americanization than because by the end of the 20th century, its appeals had proved so globally adaptive that it ceased to be seen only as Americanization. And in part three, we will want to see how this now globalized consumer century, which had once been so closely identified with the American century and had had its home in America's unique circumstances, became the undoing of the American century, or was part of the undoing. As the American century morphed into an adaptive and increasingly globalized consumer century, it became less and less centered on America's once prodigious productive capacities, and more and more on a globalized productive system that fed an insatiable appetite for consumer goods, especially in the United States itself. Americans went from being the world's primary producers to being its central consumers. An earlier emphasis on production, the role of work, pride in Fordist-style high wages, morphed into an emphasis on consumption, lower prices, and gains for investors. Americans' desire to consume things at lower and lower prices became one of the central logics of American politics. This emphasis on maintaining high consumption at home, which, as I've said, had for a century been built in to American politics and culture in intricate ways, shaped U.S. international economic policies and were part of a historic shift in America's relationship to the world economy. Note this chart showing how the cascade of imports ushered in ever-growing deficits in the U.S. balance of trade after the 1960s. Historian Charles Mayer has described this shift as one from an empire of production that you see on the left of your chart with the arrows above the line, that is, one that sought exports for its own vigorous productive capacity, a shift to an empire of consumption, that is, one that accumulated larger and larger trade imbalances by consuming an ever greater percentage of goods from elsewhere. During the period of the empire of production, the United States ran trade surpluses and was a capital lender in the world economy. As an empire of consumption, by contrast, the United States increasingly ran trade deficits to fund its appetite for cheap imports and slowly became the world's greatest debtor. U.S. consumerism, which had arisen initially as the necessary market for America's own robust and innovative productive system, now gradually stoked lower-cost production and oil-based energy sectors in the rest of the world. The market that the world had once been to America, America now became to the world. Accompanying this trend, of course, the world's largest firms became globalized and spread their sites of production and even management into widely scattered and often mobile locations. This globalization of production and the onset of all kinds of flexible manufacturing techniques accelerated during and after the 1970s as businesses reduced costs by exporting production and jobs. This chart shows the decline in manufacturing production jobs, represented by the red line, and the rise in jobs related to service industries, but more importantly, to finance, insurance, and real estate, in other words, essentially financial sorts of industries, and that's the blue line there. Note how advertising and financial industries grew rapidly as they continued to stoke mass consumer demand, pushing it to ever higher levels, even as jobs in manufacturing capacities fell sharply. The consumer century was eclipsing the core strength of the American century. Any reverse course was politically difficult. Robust consumerism and discourses of American nationalism had become so entangled that it seemed impossible to put the brakes on the escalating cycle of ever cheaper demand for ever cheaper imports and lower prices. In fact, the more incomes in this country languished, the more consumer citizens sought cheaper products and greater access to credit. The ability of Americans to consume and to borrow in order to consume had become so connected to nationalistic themes that the nation largely ignored and still continues largely to ignore the deficits in national and personal savings that accompanied its sharply deteriorating terms of trade. Debt came to signify the American way of life, especially during the past decade of soaring energy costs. If middle-class wages for the broad working class had been the American system's claim to fame at the beginning of the American century, credit cards became the central symbol of the consumer century. Credit funded America's deteriorating trade balances. Credit funded the gap between wages most people could earn and their desires for consumer products. To paper over the bubbles of debt, credit instruments became more and more abstract, less and less transparent, and less regulated. The pressures to keep the credit bubble alive and to cater to the consumer citizens thrived, especially within the highly nationalistic discourses advanced during the Republican ascendancy of the early 21st century, as this line indicates. Even as the nation's productive capacities withered and the costs of off-budget wars and tax cuts soared. Moreover, force-feeding consumer desire, initially designed to solve the problem of abundance, became increasingly anachronistic. As we have discussed, American practices emphasizing advertising and credit availability had arisen partly from its own historical abundance of cheap resources and technological innovation. But these models had always been reluctant to factor in the long-term price of environmental damage. And these models are less and less viable in the resource-scarce world, so different from that of a century ago, that we now face and is threatened with climate change. They also seem inappropriate to countries with burgeoning populations who live at the margins of employment. The consumer century, predicated on almost free natural resources and on abundance rather than scarcity, has not only eclipsed the American century, but it needs to be designed away from the American model. Economic globalization, a word that became more and more prominent from the late 1970s on, has thus brought a disjuncture between America as a bounded national state composed of citizens and an unbounded and globally networked international economy catering to consumers, especially in America. Consumer citizenship triumphed. The consumer century reigned unchallenged. The American century has withered. So let me quickly sum up the three parts of this argument that I have put together here. First, I've argued that mass consumption in America grew from attempts to manage abundance. The United States developed the first mass consumerist system out of its unique historical situation, one that mixed prodigious natural abundance that could be commodified, free nature, with robust technological innovation within an immigrant-based society. Woven tightly into institutions and identities during the 20th century, mass consumerism became central to the American way of life. During the American century, the period of maximum U.S. power and influence in the world, American models spread and expanded a consumer century globally. During the early Cold War, American-produced exports dominated world markets for goods and entertainments, and both American elites and America's critics abroad portrayed this spread of mass consumerism as Americanization. Mass production, consumption, advertising, and credit buying, however, proved highly adaptive to local cultural variations and gradually became globalized. By the late 20th century, the consumer century no longer had its national home in the United States. Every region of the globe, including once communist states, mass consumerist revolutions altered older social and cultural forms. Consumerism may have been the ism that won the ideological battles of the 20th century. It first helped unravel communist systems. It then began to undermine U.S. power. Whereas once the institutions and desire-generating technologies of mass consumerism had stoked America's productive capacity and its national cohesion, the increasingly globalized system of consumerism began to prey on America on America's consumer citizens. The central logic of mass consumerism became to drive down prices by driving down costs of productions. And America, the world's most reliable consumers, became the world's buyers of last resort as the globalized system spread its productive capacity to less expensive areas. Financial institutions, abetted by government deregulations, devised ever more elaborate credit instruments to fill the gap between what Americans produced and what they consumed. Moreover, a consumerist system in which abundance had once seemed a central problem increasingly strained an environment beset by climate change and dwindling natural resources. Through debt and environmental overuse, then, the consumer century that was once identified with the American century became its undoing. Just as the exercise of the American century's military power needs to be redesigned for the next century, and our host has had a lot to say about that in his writings, so the consumerism that once sprang from America's historically specific problem of abundance also needs to be re-engineered. And by the way, I come not to decry consumerism, by the way, but to analyze it. Getting rid of consumerism is not a solution to the set of problems that I have put out here. Indeed, it is the one thing that is absolutely not a solution because historically it is so embedded. Re-engineering can come through new technologies, through new national and international architectures to regulate irresponsible and unsound credit and selling practices. And I would argue that it is in that direction that the dilemmas between the American century and the consumer century will work out the future. Thank you.
So, could you just handle the questions?
Sure, I will be happy to. Yes. Questions, comments?
You talked about the consumerism as an agent of Americanization for America's immigrants. And
yes.
I wonder if you have any sense as to what role America's immigrants who don't stay here, those who actually return to their home countries in the late 19th, early 20th century, to what extent are they agents of Americanization that kind of lay the groundwork for this consumer, global consumer culture? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, I think it's an excellent question. And I guess what I would say is increasingly as we study these things, it makes more sense to look at flows going in all directions. First of all, I would say that those immigrants coming into America brought ideas that created many of those consumer amusements themselves. So there was never sort of an America that was not already made by the rest of the world. I think that one of the reasons that some aspects of American culture proved so popular out at large in the world is because it wasn't ever very nationally bounded. It was forged within a country that was already made up of a good bit of the world itself. So I think that those immigrants bring in really important influences that help create this thing. And then to speak to your question, I think you're absolutely right that among the flows that go back out, and as we know, immigration wasn't just an inward flow, it was a circulation of people. Certainly people are learning things and taking them back, and that becomes really important as well. So I think we have to look always at circulation rather than kind of one-way influences.
I find all this very persuasive, but so this is devil's advocate question. I don't know if you've read this new book by Bruce Cummings, Dominion from CDC.
Yes, I'm in the process.
Okay, and so this question comes to you now as a transplanted Californian. Because as I read the book, one of the things that basically he's arguing in this sort of bouquet that he throws to the Pacific Coast is that, yes, all these terrible things may be true, but what you fail to understand is the innovative capacity that is inherent in California. Time and time and time again, we look to California to generate the new resource or the new idea that becomes the engine of wealth once again, and that that's going to basically undo your gloomy assessment about the end of our consumerism. So what do you think of Bruce Cummings?
I tend to agree with him, and I suppose I came across as being gloomy, but I didn't really mean to. I think that California now, in the way that we need to think about it, is part of the Pacific Rim. And there is no California apart from this circulation with China, Japan, Korea, the dynamism, the economic dynamism that's going on there now. Our big technological innovators have decided that unless they have huge capacities, not of assembly workers, but of researchers, high-level researching, unless they have established those in China, they're going to be kind of at a handicap. So there is a dynamism in this whole region and a synergy that's going on in this region right now that's quite interesting. I'm hopeful that the Pacific Rim generally will understand the need to redesign this model of consumerism. As I say, I don't think that we can get rid of this as a cultural and economic system. I think that it, and I think that it is possible to redesign it with in ways that are responsible. So I would hope that there would be a degree of dynamism within the Pacific Rim and cooperation that might happen. I don't know. Time will tell. But so, you know, I'd like to endorse Bruce on his idea that maybe all good things will come out of California despite our impossible political deadlock, which we seem to have passed on to Washington.
All right, cultural historians, it's always about consumers and it's always about products. What does this leave out of the 20th century? If we think about American power in these terms, where's military force? Where's democracy? What are we missing when the story revolves around consumerism?
Oh, that's a really good question. I would never rule out those other things. I think that the story has been dominated by those other things so long that the contribution that this kind of investigation has to make is to change the vantage point of people who have been thinking maybe for too long in terms just of military power and of nation states. I, for example, would argue that this global spread of consumerism is extremely important to the end of the Cold War, and that to overemphasize, you know, the role of nation states and national leaders and, you know, various kinds of bilateral talks and so on, is to miss the kind of larger dynamism that happened from the 1970s on, when consumerism just went at large in the world, and the communist powers felt that they were going to be isolated and just needed to change, that it forced changes from within. So I'm not interested in replacing any of those older stories, but I am interested in shaking them up a bit and creating yet another new narrative. I also don't like to anchor my history simply in something called culture, which I don't really know what that is. But this has to do with a productive a system of production and consumption. It is economic and it is cultural, and it is that synergy between economics and culture that is important to this work. Taking the economic part out of it doesn't make any sense, right? I'm not arguing that consumerism sort of does all of these things. It's a consumerist system that is also part of an economic system of mass production.
My question is, as the United States became more consumerist society, did the character of the American people change from something to something else?
That's a really interesting question, and there's all kinds of social science theory on this. Many of the critics of consumerism, the cultural critics, particularly of the 50s and 60s, people like David Riesman and others, said that we were going from being an inner-directed people to being an outer-directed people. And I think this kind of analysis had a lot of echoes in the anti-American critiques that grew around the world, that Americans were superficial, they didn't have a center somehow, that they defined themselves through purchasing and through superficiality, not through character. I'm still puzzling over those critiques. I think they take place in a historical time. I think they're very gendered, by the way. They tend to identify consumerism with women because women were, in fact, 80% of, made 80% of the purchasing decisions throughout the 20th century. That's true now, and it was true in 1910. But those still have been very, very powerful analyses over time. I don't have an allegiance to a view on that. I'm not really sure how consumerism changed people. It certainly changed their horizons from a local community bounded by family or church or town, and suddenly a wider world in which there is incredibly more choice. That can be very dangerous and very disordering, but it can also be very liberating. And so I think you get two sides to this kind of thing. Whether we like it or not, whether we decry it or not, it seems to me that it is the postmodern condition and we're all headed there.
Please join me in thanking Professor Rosenberg, our guest, for a wonderful presentation.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by University of California, Irvine Professor Emily Rosenberg. Professor Rosenberg's lecture was presented by the International History Institute at Boston University, part of its series titled The Short American Century, 1941 to 2008, Contrasting Views of the Era of American Dominance. Professor Rosenberg was introduced by Boston University Professor of History and International Relations, Andrew Basevich. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, WBUR.org, hear archive editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Alden Furtick. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.